You're listening to a ComicsXF podcast.
WMQA.
Hello and welcome to WMQA, the ComicsXF interview podcast where two best friends talk about comics with the people who make them. I'm Dan Grote.
And I'm Matt Lazowitz. And this week's guests are the creators of the upcoming Woof Wolf from Vault, Dalen Ogden, Jackson Lansing, and Colin Kelly. Welcome.
Hi. Thanks so much for having us.
Yeah, indeed. Thank you so much. Normally, we have to introduce ourselves as best friends who do stuff together. So it's nice to have somebody else have to open with that. People are always like, oh, Colin, you get like put together as like writers. What's that like? And it's like, no. We've been best friends for 20 years. We just write together now. That's just how it works.
So our double friendship is a quad friendship plus Dalen, which is a five-way friendship. And aren't we all winners?
We are all winning.
Absolutely.
So this is probably going to be a different version of this answer that we talked about off mic, but this past weekend was Emerald City Comic Con in Seattle. At least some of you were there. How was it?
It's an incredible show. Emerald City is always like a really... we kept saying like, all around, everybody was, you talk to literally any creator from, like Chip Zdarsky to like brand new people who are like just coming in. And that's this guy Z who make this book called Zap that looks incredible. And it's the same on both sides of that aisle. You say good vibe show and they're like best vibe show. It really is just like the best vibes show. It's got great people. They have great energy. Seattle, has terrible, terrible weather that brings out the best in Colin as a native. He just loves it.
I'm from Kitsap, which is right across the water. And it turns out you put me in 40 degree weather with slightly spitting rain and a wind chill that'll cut through your jacket like a knife. And I purr like a kitten. It was so deluxe. I just loved it. And the show itself was wonderful. Jack and I are, for those who don't know, of the many books we write, one of them is Star Trek. And the Star Trek line doesn't always appeal to lots of comics readers. You're a Star Trek fan or you're a comics reader, but you are rarely both a comics reader and a Star Trek fan. And one of the things that really just filled our hearts was the fact that Seattle Comic-Con is the exception to that rule. All of the comics fans there seemed to be Star Trek fans. And we could not sell enough of those issues fast enough.
We literally had to go to the IDW booth and raid their Star Trek trades because we ran out on day two.
Which that's so amazing.
Rarely, rarely happens with Star Trek. Like much easier to move, say, Batman Beyond or Guardians of the Galaxy or Clayface One Bad Day. Like those books, we never worry about moving them because people know those characters. It's a lean in on this. And normally we really have to convince those audiences to take a shot at Star Trek, even after the Eisner nomination, right? Like we're still convincing comics readers to get on board that express. Also, shout out ComicsXF, who do the only deep dive article on that with Trek Talks. Thank you guys. I love that. I hope it gets to continue. But part of what we have managed to do with that line has been trying to make really good comics and seeing fans at Emerald City just like dive in on it and be excited and like convert to comics like right in front of us. Like we watched this couple go from we don't read comics to now we have a handful of comics because the first volume of Star Trek got them in the door, right? Like that's the dream. That's what we want out of that. So it was really lovely. And then frankly, to be able to speak to people about what's coming up, because in April with Whiff Wolf launching, we're diving back into creator owned comics. Yes, all the stuff I just said were all corporate comics, right? They're all big two or IP-driven comics. Whiff Wolf is the first thing, alongside a book we're doing at Magma Club, Principles of Necromancy, that's going to be like on the shelves from this creative team that's new and original and creator-owned since like 2016. It's been a while for us. So it's really, really exciting to start to hype people up. And Dalen, just so you know, because we haven't said, every person we show it to, their eyes fall out of their head and they just like can't shut up about how much they want it. It's really delightful.
Well, that's really, really kind.
I have a friend who writes, novelists. She writes novelists. She writes novels. Showing up for the cover of her newest book. And I was like, let me show you the cover to my newest book. And she said, Does this Dalen character do book covers?
I do do book covers, actually, as a matter of fact.
I'm going to put you two in touch.
Yes. Oh, absolutely. I love doing that kind of thing. My favorite thing in the whole world is when somebody brings me like a, here are the vibes. Can you do something that has the vibes? And I'm like, oh, baby, I live and breathe and die by the vibes. And book covers are really great for that. I think they're just like a super fun creative challenge for that reason.
Right on. Well, you guys are here to talk about Whiff Wolf, which is your graphic novel out April 24th from Vault, lettered by Ann World Design, flatted by Drew Wills.
Yes.
Matt, make like a werewolf and wake up naked in the woods, covered in blood, unsure how you got there, but certain you've done something horrible.
So Thursday nights. Okay, got it. Whiff Wolf is an original folklore myth telling the story of Charity Bjornsdottir, a young woman in 1860s Montana who spends her days in the woods with her closest friend, a local wolf she calls Silver Slash. Charity is on the precipice of marriage to the most handsome man in her small village, the mercurial yet beloved Paul Skeld. But as her husband isolates her from Silver Slash, she begins to feel a call to the wilds. For it is there that her true destiny awaits.
You just record that for a trailer sometime? That was
spicy.
That was good.
I loved it. Small claps. I don't know if these are coming up on the audio at all, but you are getting small, hopefully not obnoxious applause from me.
He's available for audio work, folks. So what is the origin of this project? Because this one goes back a ways, yeah?
It does. This goes back a long ways. I always like to tell this story because I think it's just a little bit amusing. I met Jackson first way back in the day. And Whiff Wolf sort of is tied intrinsically to the origins of our friendship as well. Because I met Jackson back at WonderCon in 2015. The one year that it was in the LA Convention Center. And it was because his wife, Alex, came by my table, liked my work, and basically came back to Jackson and was like, you gotta go see this artist. And I remember specifically, like, the part of the story that I always like to tell because it makes me laugh nowadays is I remember Jackson talking to the artist at the table next to me about the fact that he had just got done doing a book signing at the Boom booth. I believe back then it was Joyride. And I remember being like, oh my God, this guy is doing signings. Like, oh, like, wow. Like, he must be some kind of a big deal. And then he comes over to my table and I feel myself sit like ramrod straight. Like, oh God, like an actual creator. What do I do?
Just absolutely hilarious, because I was definitely just mentioning that signing because I was like, I really need something to make myself seem legit, or oh God, I'm just another person prowling artist alley looking to pinup art, and like I need to remind myself, like, oh no, I'm doing this for business. This is business. So that's hilarious.
Jackson, you caught me in that net, hook, line, and sinker. You were like, yeah, signing, and I was like, fuck, okay, all right, sit up straight, act like a professional.
Little did we all know
that we would all be just silly little goblins together eventually, but you know, can't see into the future, and it's always very, very glad to see how it shook out. But it was actually like right then and there basically that Jackson was like, do you draw comics, do you draw sequentials? And I was like, yeah. Like, at that point in my career, I had just been sort of dipping my toes into it. It wasn't like very far into my comics career, but we exchanged information because he was like, I've got a story that I think you would be perfect for. And from this point, like, I'll let you continue on with the story because there's some more twists and turns between there and here, but
yeah. So we had been Colin and I had been really interested at the time because it was pretty early in our creator-owned. This was, I mean, again, back in 2015, right? So we just produced Joyride after doing Hacktivist. I don't think we'd done anything at DC yet. We certainly hadn't done anything at Marvel or Star Trek or any of the things that fans might know us from now. We were still very much in our early stages creator-owned phase. And I think the only thing we were doing at the time was a book called Zojicon at Vault, which was how we introduced ourselves to the Vault team. We were really, really early, and we did that book when really no one knew who they were, right? It was early, early days with Vault with Zojicon. So we came in to shows like that really with the objective of let's find artists who are coming up with us, who we can look at and we can find great common values and commonality, right? Let's find those people who are sitting next to us on the roller coaster rather than the people who are like, who've been on the roller coaster 100 times or the people who are still psyching themselves up about getting on the roller coaster, right? Can we get those people who are like actually there with us and are going on the same journey, and maybe we can all team up and do something. But the trick to that is a lot of the times, especially when you're early, the art isn't necessarily there yet. Like you have to see into the future and be like, oh, this person is going to be incredible. Or like this person has a lot of talent, but like they're still at the beginning of their space. Because if they aren't, probably they've already got the big job that you want to give them, right? So you're like, you're sort of looking out. The thing about Daylan and what Alex told me when she came back, and just the caveat here is that my wife is an animation producer, so she looks at art for a living, like that's her job. So she is a big part of what she does is be discerning about artists. She looked at the art and came back to me and said, oh, Daylan's ready. And so when we went over to them to look at the art, it was like the only thing we had to ask was, do you do sequentials? Because everything else was like already there. You could look at the pinup work and be like, well, this is amazing. There's a sense of style. There's a sense of composition. There's a sense of like personal style. Like there's like this is clearly Daylan's art and not someone else's art. Like it's very specific. And this is what led to Whiffwolf. There was actually like narrative going on. There were characters that they were using. There was a sense of repeat action. There was a lot of wolves. There was a lot of this stuff where you're like, oh, this is, there's already a sense of like who the audience is and what kind of stories I'm telling them. And so Colin and I had this short story that we gave to Daylan to be like, maybe we do this together. We'd written this little short. Maybe we'll play around with this. And to their enormous credit, they came back. The story was kind of built on some like Navajo myth stuff that maybe as like white guys, we shouldn't be like appropriating without a sense of like how to really like make it into something great. I think we were talking about something we didn't entirely know how to talk about, which is the thing you do a lot when you're a young writer. And Daylan was like, hey, I think maybe we should like get some Navajo eyes on this and like get a sense of what is going on here. And I had a Navajo friend look at it and he was like, yeah, you probably shouldn't do this. And I was like, great. So we called up Daylan instead and said, hey, what do you got? Like, what do you have in the back pocket? What are you sitting on? What kind of story do you want to tell? How can we help you do that? Because I think rather than us like bringing you another script, we'd love to find something that we all build together. And then I'll hand it to Colin.
Oh, I mean, yes. I mean, during that time, we were doing effectively, we in the height of hubris, we thought that the right move was an anthology series. So we popped off a whole bunch of short stories to find these artists. And indeed, some of them were not right. And it turns out putting together an anthology series is incredibly difficult. So once we kind of engaged with Daylan and asked, hey, what do you want to draw? They came back with kind of, have you met my booth? And in the booth is a absolutely arresting image of a woman wearing a wolf skull, blood dripping down her hands and her face. And you can tell that it's steeped in lore, but lore that was completely unique to the image. Effectively, Daylan was like, well, have you met Whiffwolf? And that was a character that had been developing in the back of her mind for quite a while, but was this incredibly powerful force of nature, specifically feminine power, that whose story had yet to be told. And it was still kind of gestating. And the fact that Daylan kind of started to open up that story to us, two people who were incredibly enthusiastic and open and honest. I think anybody who knows us knows that our cool is very limited and our enthusiasm is at maximum.
Yes.
And all we wanted to do was help uplift and somehow expose Daylan's art to the world using what little platform we had, because the world deserved to see it. And then so we started to be told the story of Whiffwolf. And that is a story that maybe did.
Yeah, I mean, speaking as your guys' collaborators, there's a couple of asides I wanted to make here. Jackson, the next time I see your wife, I'm going to kiss her tenderly on the forehead. Please let her know that I adore her. Like, it means so much to me that Alex just, she walked past my WonderCon booth and it has domino affected my whole life since then. She single-handedly butterfly affected me.
She will be glad to hear that. That's like her dream comment.
Well, yes, please let her know, because I will forever be thankful for that chance meeting that first day. But yeah, I mean, speaking as your guys' collaborator, I can 100% corroborate that you guys are perpetual motion machines of enthusiasm, positivity, empathy, excitement. Part of what makes this project so beautiful is that it is very vulnerable. And at no point in our creative journey together have I ever felt like I couldn't be vulnerable with you guys. Like, I remember the first time with that first script being so nervous to hit send on that email of like, hey guys, like maybe we should look into some sensitivity reading just to make sure we're all on the up and up. But the way that you guys responded to that feedback has forever cemented you guys as amazing collaborators. Because like the humility there and the willingness to step outside yourselves and, you know, take that feedback. There's a lot of people in the world, and I would say in creative industries in general, this runs a little bit rampant. People who are so married to their own work that they can't help but have a little bit of an ego about it. And I think it's something that we all do our best to combat against. But when something that you create is so intimately tied with who you are as a person, as art is, it can be really easy to be defensive about those things and to want to resist any kind of feedback or critique or open dialogue that might ask you to reconsider something that you have made for yourself. And I remember that being the first thing where I was like, oh, like these guys are someone I can absolutely work with, because these people, like these two, they get it, you know, like they get that there are some things that are way more important than just your first creative vision that you come out with. And so bringing you guys with Wolf felt really, really easy to do. You know, it was like it was a piece that I had done initially after reading about Medina, the Lithuanian goddess of the forest, and being really inspired by her because she is very much this like goddess of the forest character. Her patron animals are both the hare and the wolf. And she is different from other like European pantheons in the sense that she is not the goddess of the hunt. She is the goddess of the woods. In a lot of ways, she's the goddess of the hunted. And so that was like very, very compelling subject matter for me, something that I wanted to explore. And I remember bringing you guys this piece and you guys being like, yeah, like we can absolutely do something with this. Like, you know, let's channel a little bit of like Eggers is the witch, you know, stuff like that. Like we weren't sure at the very beginning whether we wanted her to be kind of an anti-hero, a hero, a good guy, a bad guy, a witch, a goddess. We wanted to sort of land kind of in the middle of all of those things. And what I think really set this book up for what it is today is the very initial pass of the script introduced this idea of this young woman who becomes the Whiff Wolf, but before then she is in an abusive relationship. And I have some experience with that. So that was the part that really opened the door for me. Like initially, when I concepted on the Whiff Wolf, she wasn't necessarily a right out of the gate symbol of my own liberation. But when you guys cracked the door, I realized that that was a door I really wanted to walk through.
And it was immensely gratifying to be trusted with the story from you. And it was a real honor to be able to help, you know, excise this wound, right? We had this kind of hurt needs to be aired in order to really let things heal. And what are all of us, if not people who need to heal ourselves through art? So even as
100%, I think that over the course of making this book, because this was a book that we chipped away at on the back burner for so long before we managed to, you know, really, really make the actual push at it. But like over the course of my time creating this book and excising this wound, like this, the end of this book changed from the first, and without spoiling it, obviously, but from the first iterations to the final one, the ending of this book changed because I changed.
Yeah. Well, and I think that's the interesting thing about this book, just from a process perspective. And I feel like we're just never going to let you guys ask questions again. You've opened up the door and now just the Whipwolf team just talks. But the interesting thing about that process, as opposed to most process in comics that we do, especially because we do corporate comics a lot. So like, by which I mean, again, Big Two, Star Trek, stuff like that. So as we do that, generally there's a pretty straightforward process, which is the editor works with the writer to crack the concept. The writer writes the script. The script goes to the artist draws the script, and then you're off, right? Maybe there's a little bit of back and forth between the artist and the script writer if the artist is a particularly like intense storyteller or has a lot of like, you know, has like direct opinions and knows what they want, like Kev Walker on Guardians, for instance. But this was very different. This was Dalen comes to us and talks to us about their actual lived experience, right? We find ways to frame that lived experience for ourselves as two people who, no matter what we do, we will never be in the same kind of abusive relationship that they were in, because that is a gendered relationship. It's built on certain assumptions about gender that, as men, Colin and I don't have the same framework. But we do understand abuse. We've both been through it in our own ways. We've been through those processes and we've written about it to some degree in like Kang the Conqueror, for instance, very much about abuse visited upon us by our, like male figures in our lives, right? And then the abuse that we can see ourselves perpetuating and the ways to stop that, right? Like we had to turn that around and look at ourselves from the outside in order to better understand this story and sort of open up that empathy that allowed us to start writing the story. So then the process became one where the artist was the editor in large part. We sort of use that as a shorthand. Dalen, throughout most of the creative process on this book, was the editor. We were coming in and we were saying, okay, here's a draft. And people who buy Whipwolf will see the draft of the outline in the book. We put it in the book so they can see how the book has grown over this process. A big part of Whipwolf is process. So we wanted to make sure that it was shown in that because it's just such a unique project like that. But we did this outline. Dalen looked at that outline, came back and said, hey, maybe this, maybe that, maybe this. I've been thinking about this beat. We would revise. And then several months later, we would take a huge amount of time away and we would come back and Dalen would be like, you know, my thought process has evolved on this. And maybe I'm thinking about it this way. What do you guys think about this? And we'd like, we just make it this constant conversation until we were all able to look at it and say, okay, this is the story. This is the amount of pages it's going to need. This is the amount of time it's going to need, the amount of money we'll need to produce it. And that allowed us to move to a phase where we could reasonably put our money where, well, put our backers' money where our mouths were and take this to Kickstarter and start that process.
Yes.
So I always ask this of our guests when they bring werewolf stories or Whipwolf stories. So this is no different. Favorite piece of werewolf media, but Whipwolves only.
Whipwolves only. Well, obviously, then I got to go immediately for Ginger Snaps.
Mm-hmm.
Come on, man.
Ginger Snaps fucks. What can I say? Like, or 100%. Ginger Snaps Back, the one where they're like in the medieval sort of like fantasy land version of it. Like, all of that shit rules. I think Whipwolves are deeply underrepresented in media.
That is true. Female werewolves, Whipwolves in general, not a thing you're going to get as much out of. I really like Julie Delpy in An American Werewolf in Paris.
Mm.
But I just like, that's just because I like Julie Delpy in general. So I don't know how much of that is an actual reflection on that movie versus me just being like, Julie Delpy rips. My actual answer is a little bit of a cheat because it's not a werewolf or a whiff wolf. It's a whiff cat, but Cat People.
Oh,
I love Cat People. I grew up on Cat People. Cat People is just a movie that like lives rent free in my brain and probably will forever. I saw it when I was too young. And so Cat People is just up in here and I can't help it. So I love Cat People.
I am a simpler man, who loves, Buffy the Vampire Slayer.
Ah.
I believe I'm trying to...
Veruca.
Yes, thank you very much. Thank you very much. I think Buffy is one of the greatest shows ever made. And you can't... Who cares about production value when you have such great emotional content?
I know that this was mostly a question about like visual and storytelling mediums, but I'd also love to give a shout out to the song Howl by Florence and the Machine.
Yes.
That is Whiffle coded as hail.
It's really fun. When we did the Kickstarter, Dalen came out to Los Angeles and we did a party just like at my house for like friends who had helped back the thing and just, you know, to show our appreciation and get the party a little bit for all of ourselves. And Dalen and I worked on a playlist that I still have that is like it's just all werewolf or like howling themed songs that then just degenerates into a dance mix. But for a while it's very on theme.
Wow, I feel like really
I'll post it when Whiffle was finally out.
Yes, absolutely. And we have to bust it out again when we party again, when we have our secondary Wolf Wolf party for when the book finally drops.
So close. We're so close.
So close. And
if folks are in the Los Angeles or Denver areas when the book does launch, keep your eyes open because we are going to be doing our best to do signings in both places to celebrate both sides of our cultures. Do we have culture in Los Angeles?
I'm sure in Los Angeles, you guys are the culture.
You're very sweet. We are a small pool in a big pond. But we will be doing two absolutely howl-rific parties in both locations. So,
oh, yes.
I'm sure people will, if you want to come howl with us, you'll be able to find us. Oh,
Matt, what is your whiff wolf of choice there?
Well, it's definitely... Ginger Snaps. I mean, it's just a truly one of the best horror movies, and does so much with the metaphor. Although, if you're talking about that metaphor, there's also Alan Moore and Stephen Bissett's The Curse.
Mm.
Yeah, sure.
So uses the same feminism and werewolf analogy as Ginger Snaps does. There's another, but I can't say it without spoiling the end of a movie.
Oh. I can't say the title without spoiling it?
Because it's a mystery, and because if I say it's a whiff wolf and not a werewolf, it tells you who is...
I know what you're talking about, and that is an excellent whiff wolf.
You guys can message me off camera because I want to know.
I'm not sure what you're
talking about, but I would very much like to know.
Yeah,
we'll tell you. Assuming
we're talking about the same thing, it's a TV show.
No, it's a movie. Although it might be, there was a TV a British adaptation of the same book that was adapted into the film.
Oh no, yeah, we're talking about totally different things then. That's great. I love it.
Yeah. Okay. Oh my gosh. Oh, well, I want both your guys' recommendations, please, and thank you, because I am a werewolf media consumer across the board.
I will say it's not a great werewolf on screen. It's basically just a big old dog, but it's the construction of the movie that makes it interesting.
There are no bad werewolves, just like there are no bad dogs. All right, so they are all acceptable. They can all run with the pack.
And now that I've said it, there's actually another one too that just came to mind. That again, it's the same. They're both of them are Who's the Werewolf movies, and I don't want to give it away.
Okay, well, spoilers don't bother me. So off camera later, I want your recommendations because I would very much like to enjoy and consume those things.
Yeah. Once we are done with the recording, I will tell you.
Yes, please. Or you can tell us and you can just edit in like a duck quacking or something. I kid. But actually, like your mention of Ginger Snaps too in this intersection of like horror as a vector for feminism, I think is super, super interesting because I think that this is also not a werewolf movie, but it is a feminine monster movie. I would also say that Jennifer's Body scratches that itch for me.
Yeah.
It is very much this intersection of like horror, feminine rage, and like camp that is just like so underappreciated, I think.
Have you seen Lisa Frankenstein yet?
I haven't yet. It keeps catching my eye though, because people keep being like, it's like very much like Jennifer's body, where like people who get it, but it's getting kind of panned by people who don't. And I'm like, oh, I'm all in for that. I love Jennifer's body.
It's even campier than Jennifer's body.
Oh, and even better.
It's got a touch of like early Burton to it, that Pee-wee Edward Scissorhands look, because it's set in the 80s. Mm-hmm. But I thought Catherine Newton is so much fun, and Cole Sprouse does a great job, and I enjoyed the hell out of it.
Hell yeah. Okay, so this has obviously been a really long and spiral conversation, but Dan, who is your Wiffle?
Okay, so I had to do research because my horror game is weak, especially compared to Matt. But it's funny, I found this like sort of like listicle site that was just like GIFs of like alphabetized appearances of Wiffwolves, Lady Werewolves throughout like television and film. It was yet another reminder that I need to watch The Beast Must Die, first of all. But also, as somebody who never watched Supernatural, they apparently went to the Wiffwolf well a number of times and possibly forgot that they did it over 15 seasons. Because the number of actresses that they had listed and sort of doing like transformation gifts was like, oh, I'm still in the Supernaturals here. Wow, that is...
Oh, wow.
I mean, it's kind of a core metaphor in a lot of ways, just because a werewolf does represent in a lot of different perspectives, they represent a lot of different things, but feminine rage. Like, there is just something about going from a beautiful farmer's daughter or a beautiful waif, right, as the world sees you as such a perfect little doll, and then effectively wolfing out and shredding their fucking faces off. Mm-hmm. Because I think there's what woman has not walked through this world and at one point said, God damn, I want to just eat this guy's fucking head. And I think that's something that that's very real and something that pop culture definitely keys into.
Well, wildly. I mean, I think that's it, if you really want to get down into it, right? I think that's the success of a show like Yellow Jackets, right? That's the, like, I think if you were to ask me, like, oh, what's your favorite piece of Wiffwolf fiction? Probably, actually, upon examination, it's Yellow Jackets. It's not a show about werewolves, but it is a show about feral femininity, about the distinction between societally accepted femininity and feral femininity. And that premise of what it means to be feral is in many ways the central question of Wiffwolf. That's why we wrote this book in large part, is because it's about that urge. And it's not just a feminine urge, right? It is a universal urge to be a monkey for a second, right?
Oh,
to throw yourself back into that like totally primal state where all of this pomp and circumstance and civilization and all of these things that provide you comfort but also provide you structure and in some ways as a result provide you limits are removed, and you are thus limitless, if not in actuality, certainly in your own mind. And Wiffwolf is very much, it's not like, the thing that distinguishes Wiffwolf, I think, from almost every other piece of werewolf fiction we've talked about, is that this is not the birth of a werewolf. This is the birth of a goddess. The premise of this character is not that she becomes a werewolf. The premise of this character is that she becomes all wolves. And that what that connective tissue between her and the premise of wolves and the run of wolves, of the howl of wolves, of the will of the feral nature of wolves, that is the connection that we're going after, not simply, man, I can't wait to tear his face off. Though, man, I can't wait to tear his face off is the stepping stone that gets you to that, you know, that awakening, that evolution, that apotheosis.
Man, I can't wait to join the pack.
Exactly. Right. Yep. But that when you join that pack, especially as a human, you will never be a wolf. You are something more. You are as a wolf. But in being accepted by that, Charity, again, without getting into spoiler territory, is really offered an opportunity to become something different than what she is and be able to, like Colin and I at the beginning of this conversation, we get to look at ourselves, and frankly, Dalen, in doing this through fiction, right, is able to step out of herself and look at herself from the perspective of wolves, from the perspective of nature, from a perspective that does not belong to Charity Bjornsdottir. Charity Bjornsdottir is an egg. The Wiffwolf is what emerges.
Yes, 100%. As they say in the memes, aren't you tired of being nice? Don't you just want to go apeshit? That's the question. I think we are like, we are in a phase of media where we're like, we're entering the age of feminine rage, which makes me so excited to be like releasing With Wolf to the public when we are. Because this is a moment in history where I think that like feminine rage is, I mean, societally, obviously, structurally, it's still not welcome, but we are entering a mounting wave where feminine rage is welcome. And I'm excited to be a part of that.
And we're excited for you.
What drew you to the specific setting of Montana in the 1860s?
So part of that comes from the natural settings in Dalen's work from the start. Dalen's from Colorado. There's an enormous amount of that sort of Midwest mountain feeling in what Dalen does. I also grew up in Longmont, like, for a few years myself. So, like, I have a little bit of that, like, in my child brain somewhere in the back of that idea of like looking out over the Rocky Mountains and imagining the wilderness beyond, right? Mm-hmm. So I think there's something just naturally imaginative about that setting. Time period felt really important to us, primarily because as a myth, it had to really feel like it was pre-modern. And you'll see in the book why, if only because we do actually reflect modernity in a sort of story, like a post-Cole story that happens. Like there's a prose piece that's packaged with the book that deals with the sort of Whip Wolf within a modern context. So we knew we wanted to deal with it in a more of a mythic context. And we knew that it had to not be mythic like you know, we didn't want this to be like a thing that happened so far back that you were seeing it as a myth. This had to be a folk horror. So in that Robert Eggers mode, it was about looking at where are the folk stories, where are the folk settings that have wolf populations that feel properly remote, that feel like they're in a setting where a woman could be forced into a marriage, where the ramifications of what comes next could reasonably run for the next, you know, couple of decades, given the sort of scope and scale of the concept.
And also, really importantly, as far as the year goes, this is very much a story of the post-Civil War.
Yeah, that's a plot.
Yes.
Well, but even then, it's emotional, right? Because what we see in especially that war is the first time that brother was truly turned against brother. And it's always phrased like that, right? The war is a masculine field. And for this is the first time in a lot of ways, I mean, you know, one might even point to something like Vietnam, where we realized because of the horror that we were unleashing, we were ourselves kind of the baddies, right? Like we were unleashing this pain on ourselves, even though we had to tell ourselves that we were victorious, because otherwise our masculinity would start to crack and falter as a culture. That is the kind of pain that we wanted our hero, Paul Skeld, to be coming back from, right? That fundamental schism, that break in what you conceive of as a masculine figure, and how by being unable to reckon who you think you are with what you actually have done, create that trauma point. Because as much as Paul is not a good dude, every one of us, every man has the potential to be that. And if you are unable to examine your own trauma, right? Just every human being, if you are unwilling to look at the trauma, both that has been caused by you and that you have caused, you are incapable of growing. And I think Charity and Paul in a lot of ways are direct mirrors to each other in terms of different directions this can take. But the Civil War was one of the first true wounds on the American psyche. And that is what we wanted to kind of bring forward into the story.
Yeah, I also think that it's worth mentioning that Paul is a Union soldier. He is a Northern soldier. And so in that way, we are positioning him as someone who is ostensibly one of the good guys. But there is so much more complication to that. You know, you can be fighting on the right side and still not be that good of a person. You can be doing the right things for the wrong reasons or the wrong things for the right reasons. And I think that, like, setting that part of this as like a sort of backdrop mood or vibe of the main plot was also a way for us to acknowledge that, like, it's much bigger and much more complicated than a lot of abuse narratives portray, because a lot of abusers in media are portrayed as being one-dimensional. They're assholes, they're mean, they are cruel for the sake of being cruel, and they don't have anything else going on. And they're masochists because they love it, or sadists because they love it, not masochists. And I think that it was important here to acknowledge that, like, our main character, again, without giving too much away, he is carrying a deep pain of his own. It doesn't justify his actions, but it helps us as the readers look at this for a moment and be like, how can I recognize those things in my own life? Who am I making excuses for their behavior because I know they're carrying a deep pain? And how can I then free myself a little bit from that? Because I, as a person around a person who has deep pain, am not responsible for that deep pain being how they treat me. Like, so it was that sort of, like, that sort of implied nuance there that I think makes this a folklore, but also, like, a very, very, like, human tale.
So one of our grand Twitter inquisitor, Asma Fangirl, wanted to know, Dalen, what are some of the most difficult and more enjoyable things that you drew for this story?
Oh, gosh. That's a really, really good question. Some of the most difficult parts, I think, were trying to reconcile this historical setting with making sure that I didn't sacrifice the vibes and the themes for perfect accuracy, because I'm very much the kind of person where, like, if I'm going to draw a setting, like, I'm going to research native plants. I want to draw historically accurate guns. I want to make sure everybody's wearing the correct outfits and things like that. But I had to pull myself back from that a little bit and remember that ultimately I am telling a story to modern audiences who don't have the same kind of, like, hyper fixation interest as I do into every, like, setting. You know, like, I don't have a lot of the women in Wiff Wolf wearing bonnets, even though in the 1860s and 70s, they would ostensibly all be wearing bonnets and headwear, you know, like, Charity never does. But I knew that, like, that was something I wanted to tell people about her character, her little bit of, like, off kilterness with the fashion, even though it's not historically accurate, was another point where I was like, no, like, you need to let go of the fact that, that this wouldn't actually probably be like this at the time, and embrace the fact that you are telling people a story and you are telling them about Charity with the choices, the visual choices that you make. Like, I had to stop myself a bunch of times. I had to be like, stop fucking researching what kinds of plants natively grow in what season in this forest. It doesn't matter. I'm telling you a story with the flowers that I choose, you know? Like,
Let me just call out for a second, though. That didn't stop Dalen from doing that research, nor putting that into the book. In fact, you will find in the back of the book a section specifically dedicated to the meanings of each of the plants available throughout the book and why they are the way that they are within the framework of the book. Like, this was that, like, you know, You're a humble person with like, who wants to, like, make a funny Dalen, so I get it. But at the same time, like, that rips that you did that you went into there and found a way to, like, pull all of that forward. The whole book is better for that obsession. You know what I mean?
Yes. Oh, absolutely. And I think that was the balance that I had to strike, right? Is I had to strike, like, okay, like, there are all of these things where I can inject meaning. And what that means is I have to let go of the idea that this particular plant would be growing in this particular season, in this setting, in this area, in this growing area of the United States. Like, I had to be like, no, Nope, I'm going to let that go, because what this flower, what this plant symbolizes and says is more important to me than making sure that, like, the botanist who reads this book gives it a completely clean bill of health. But that said, like, I think that, like, the metaphor of plant symbolism and natural symbolism is one of the things that I guess leading into all of this is that I really, really enjoyed doing in the book. It was probably my biggest enjoyment and my greatest challenge was finding a way to insert as many little details as possible that reinforce the story in such a way that, like, I say this a lot about lettering, but it's true about comics in general. You know, if you're doing your job right, people don't necessarily realize consciously that you're doing it. They are so caught up in what it is that you're creating and the story that you're telling that they're not necessarily taking that time to stop and put, you know, the craft underneath a magnifying lens to appreciate every little part of it. But every little part of it is married to the whole and pushes the story forward. So in that sense, like, there are multiple shots of Charity standing at a window that is webbed up with spider web because she is caught in a trap. Things like that. I inserted a lot of little tiny details like that because I wanted astute readers to also be able to see a little bit more between the lines. To continue on with other things that I really enjoyed about the book, I really enjoy drawing all of the shiny guts and gore. I'm like definitely like a body horror artist at heart.
Truly disgusting prints available at their booth.
Yeah, it's true. I'm a nasty boy. But like you would think that having to draw a bunch of pictures of like my favorite animals or people in like various states of like evisceration would ruin my day. But not so, actually. I find a lot of really compelling, interesting places where violence becomes a metaphor for something that is not necessarily violent itself. Mm-hmm. And I think, again, that circles back to how compelling werewolves are, because a lot of times werewolves are violence as a metaphor for just wanting to be who you are. Be natural, be exactly unfiltered, your wild and feral self, and the freedom to do that without consequences in a society where we face consequences for stepping outside of the norm, for asking for too much, for upsetting people. Werewolves are a violent metaphor for this near universal longing just to let go and be free.
So touching back on the plants for a second.
Oh, yes, please.
Do you feel like after all that research, you could arrange a kick-ass yet deeply ominous bouquet with all that knowledge?
Oh, yeah. Oh, absolutely. I definitely could. I am definitely like the kind of like hyper-fixative neurodivergent person that I probably could have done it before Wiff Wolf too. But after Wiff Wolf, certainly.
Bespoke, coming to you soon, bespoke Dalen Ogden bouquets sent to your favorite frenemy that say, I love you, now die.
I'm single-handedly bringing back the Victorian language of flowers, just by myself.
I want to know, Jack, what was your favorite part of Dalen's art as Dalen's art started to come in? What was the part that really blew your mind and that you absolutely loved seeing?
You can't see me, but I'm leaning closer to the camera because I'm listening really hard.
No, it's really easy for me. What has always appealed to me about this story is the more, as is probably indicated by my audio answers thus far, is the like esoterica, not by which I mean like the weird little details, but the like God level apotheosis stuff. I think the way that the spiritual is defined in this book and how it's described, because so little of this book is expository. All of our big two muscles of like, here's the whole story behind this supernatural thing. Now you can understand every interlocking piece and your continuity brain can understand all of it. None of that is here. We do not explain any of our terms. We are here to get you in and out on an emotional and spiritual case. And so I think while Dalen really nailed the emotional experience that is sort of the first half of the book with Charity in her sort of trap of a marriage, as soon as she escapes that, the double page spread that starts that second half of the book and leads us into her transformation and where she goes from there, I think is where Dalen's art, no one can do what they do there. Like that's where when you walk up to that booth at WonderCon in 2015 and you look at the art that's on display there, that artist is still drawing that book, right? You can really look at those pages and be like one to one, okay. Like the sequential stuff, especially early on, was an evolution for Dalen. It was new stuff. Well, as we get into the back, this is the stuff that Dalen got famous doing. Like it's the reason people go to their work. It's the reason why we first leaned in is like, there is an eye towards taking the feral and making it holy. And that part of it is just like, boom, like I think it just nails it there near the end. So that is what I like. So that is my favorite part. That's the part that got me dancing around my office.
Well, thanks.
Okay, now you ask me.
Oh yeah, Colin, what's your favorite part?
Oh, the hair. Oh, Dalen spends all this time drawing these luscious locks of beautiful tumbling hair.
My elbows don't work anymore, but it's worth it.
Oh, it's so sensuous. You just want to rub your face in that beautiful hair, rub your hands through it. And then that translates to Silver Slash's fur and the fur on all of these wolves. It is bristly, it is jagged, but at the same time, it invites you to run your fingers through it. It makes these very dangerous beasts have a certain amount of, not even softness, but welcoming to them. I mean, it's so strange to think that it's hair, right? It's just hair design. It's just follicles. It's just fluff. But Dalen makes it so welcoming and engaging that you absolutely kind of want to dive right into those textures. And that's my first answer. My second answer, because that's what brings you in on the inks. And then my dudes, you get to the colors. And I think that is the thing that people are not ready for because we haven't heard us talk about the colorist. And that's because Dalen is their own colorist. All of this is put together top to bottom by Dalen's unique vision, and the colors combine both the kind of sepia of Montana during the age, the natural world that is very real and very authentic, with, as Jack points out, the kind of psychedelia and esoterica of what this actual story is kind of evolving into. So you do not expect to see a rainbow spectrum of light and color within this kind of, you know, naturalistic Montana setting. But when you do, it takes your breath away. And I think that is really where Dalen's art does really shine, is in the coloring, the combination of a full spectrum of color, of metallic, of gold, but then mashed up against something as clean as black, white, and blood. It's just a really breathtaking combination of skills. And I don't think anyone, you know, like maybe in Becky Cloonan's Fever Dreams.
Right? Oh, stop. Becky, you take that back right now. I'm coming to your house. Becky Cloonan is like my hero. I
can't, obviously.
Love her like to an embarrassing amount. So
we got to hang out at Emerald City this week a bit, and I was similarly starstruck. I love Becky Cloonan's work desperately. Genuine. And look, Becky, as both an artist and a writer, is like a huge influence on this book. I think in general, I think that sense of being able to take human and very like almost surreal human experience and then float it through surreal like fantasy is just such a unique skill. And so God knows we all learned at the feet of Becky Cloonan on this book.
Becky Cloonan makes art that makes it clear that she is deeply and madly in love with how terrifying the world is. And that is something that I have always tried to chase in my own work as well.
Dalen, you'd be so proud of me. I got the last issue of Becky Cloonan and Tula Lote's new smut comic.
Oh, I'm jealous. I keep getting advertisements for it on Instagram, and I'm like, God, I can't get my hands on that.
It is both steamy and deeply horrifying. It is. I'll loan you a copy later. It came in a black.
As all good things should be, steamy and deeply horrifying.
I mean, it's like, what if we made the sexiest possible comic about sleep paralysis? It's like, woof, right on, guys.
Like, I'm sold. I'm completely sold. Like, that is that's the center of the Venn diagram where I live. Like, that's what I want. Oh my god.
It's there for you.
Pulling this up on Amazon right now and buying it.
There you go. Somna, everybody. Somna.
Somna. Oh,
Somna get with Wolf. They're actually really nice pairing. They're actually a wildly nice pairing given having now read Somna. They are wildly similar books, except that their book has way more sex than our does.
Oh, man. Yep. Well, I'm sold. All right, fine. Somna it is. I'm in. This is a Somna podcast now, everybody. I'm so sorry.
And while everyone's purchasing Somna, go ahead and pre-order Whip Wolf, coming soon from Bolt Comics.
I'm just like such an unapologetic Becky Cloonan fangirl. Like, her work has in so many ways informed mine because I admire her so deeply. So you got me started, unfortunately. So now I can't help myself. We have to change the subject. Otherwise, I'm just going to spend the whole rest of our time gushing about how great she is.
Matt, save us.
It's literally his job to ask the next question.
Mine is the next question. How did you wind up choosing Vault as your publishing partner for comic shops and such?
So Vault was a pretty no-brainer choice for us for a couple of reasons. The first is that Colin and I have already worked with them twice. We know Damian and Adrian very well, and we've worked with Tim on design. We've worked with pretty much everybody there, David on their marketing team. We just know these guys, and we know how to get in touch with them. We know that they know what they're doing. We know how good they are at their jobs. And so for us, when we were talking about the need for a publisher, which we can talk about how we sort of got there, they were a pretty obvious choice, just given the framework and given the relationships that we already had. The reason why we went for a publisher at all was because of the sheer response to the Kickstarter. I think all of us, after many years of working on this, really didn't expect that we would be producing as many copies of this book as there will eventually be. I think we really saw this as a much more niche project at first, one that was mostly something we were all doing for ourselves, not something we were doing for like huge mass market appeal. And so that's why we took it to Kickstarter. We've never done a Kickstarter before. We were paralyzed by it. Thank all the stars for Jaslyn Stone, who came in and helped us run that, helped us understand what we were doing, helped us build a cascade of social posting and of updates and of and helping us build a campaign that actually looked like what we wanted to produce and that promised the right things without overpromising. I think ultimately a big part of what we did on that side of things then created this giant swell of interest, which outstripped anything any of us were expecting. You know, the day that Kickstarter kicked off and we fully funded within 24 hours, Dalen was just texting me every 10 minutes with money updates, and Colin and I were just like, it was still in the middle of the pandemic. We had nowhere to go. We all just like walked around our houses constantly, like nervous wrecks, being like, oh my God, are we actually going to get to do this book? Are we going to have to come up with stretch goals? Like, what's going on? And then around the time that we got about a third of the way through the campaign, once it became clear that we were going to go well above our goals and that there really was like direct commercial interest for this book, we, you know, IO9 picked it up, like people wrote articles about it. And suddenly we were like, okay, now, you know, press is starting to find out about this. Maybe this book is a little bigger than we think it is. Maybe there is a market for this more than we know. Well, if we wanted to take that out directly or we wanted to go through Image, that would be a lot of a learning process for us. That would be maybe too much of a learning process for a book that is also a Kickstarter. And we need to fulfill to our backers, and then we need to fulfill to comic stores, and in that order, which has been very specific to us and has been something that we've talked about a lot over this campaign. Now, obviously, we had a lot to learn as indicated by the fact that the book has taken as long as it has to produce. The book has taken much longer than we anticipated to produce. And that is, that responsibility falls on every member of this team. Not just the creative team, but on everybody at Vault. It's everybody. We've all had a lot of learning experience along this process to get this book where it needs to go, right? But we're finally, like, we have our feet under us. We know where, you know, everything is printed. Everything is making its way. Everything is manufactured. Like, we're doing it. Everything is in process so that we can actually put this book out now. And it meant getting all of these ducks in a row. And I think when we looked at getting all those ducks in a row and we said, oh, and beyond those ducks, we're going to take this book out to the comic book market. We're going to put it in previews. We're going to get it out to Barnes & Nobles and bookstores. And we're going to get it out into catalogs. And we're going to put it out through, you know, Penguin Random House, whatever. Like, that just seemed so much farther beyond what we were capable of doing at the time that we put this Kickstarter up than we were ready to do. And so we made contact with Vault sort of simultaneous to them making contact with us. I think we all knew that this was right. If we could make this work, it really fit into the kind of books that Vault produces, the kind of interesting, introspective, thoughtful fantasy and sci-fi that they do. This felt like a great, like, connective tissue there. We knew that Adrian wouldn't overburden us with, like, creative notes. We knew that he would very much, like, understand that this was our project and that we were going to work from there. We were able to make a great deal with Vault by which we kept our rights, which is something that even at Vault is very rare. The idea of coming in on these projects, and, like, this is still a 100% creator-owned project, which just isn't true of projects at most companies, even at creator-owned companies like IDW or Dark Horse or Vault, you don't see 100% creator ownership. You'll see the creator retaining the copyright, but that's different than the creator retaining their rights. So we retained our rights, and that was something we could do because we had money, right? We came in with the backers. The backers allowed that to happen. They made that possible. And so their confidence in us led to Vault's confidence in us and our confidence in Vault. And we all just, like, work together to make this thing what it can be. And obviously, as previously stated, just because it needs to be said to all of our backers, and obviously we've said it quite a bit in the updates, this book has definitely taken longer than any of us wanted for it to come out. And we do apologize to anybody who was like, man, I bought this book for a friend 2 years ago. Why don't I have this book? We really do understand that. It's been top of mind for us genuinely for years to fulfill this thing and make sure that this book is as good as humanly possible. And what I can say now with, like, total unequivocation, right, the book is worth it. The final product is killer, and we are really, really proud of it, and it's worth all of the time and effort that went in on Dalen's part, on our part, on Vault's part to get it where it needs to go.
So it's funny, Dalen, we were talking about this off mic, similarly. You're playing Wolf in a tabletop RPG.
Oh, I mean, I'm playing a werewolf, but as I've previously mentioned, werewolves have been and continue to be a very compelling concept for me personally. So I am not playing the Wolf in terms of, like, playing Charity, but I am playing another werewolf girl who is struggling and reconciling with the fact it's pretty different from Whipwolf, because, as we've talked about, you know, Whipwolf is all about not becoming a werewolf but becoming the wolves. Meanwhile, my Moondred Bloodhunter, she is reconciling with the fact that she has this wild and uncontrolled ability that has been used by other people for harm all of this time, and she has spent so much time fighting with herself, looking for her place in the world, trying to figure out how she can find safety and love in a world that doesn't accept the more dangerous aspects of her. And my hope is that her character arc is a little bit similar to the Whipwolf's, in the sense that she does come into her own self and has that internal reckoning that allows her to not only accept but embrace the parts of herself that she has been afraid of in the past. And in that sense, all werewolf media is the same. No, I kid. But I think that, like, a lot of the positively spun werewolf media, I think that that's an important thread that we all kind of touch on, is that, like, how do you how do you not only accept, but learn to like harness and even enjoy the parts of yourself that might be a little scary at first blush? Like, how do you learn to love yourself so much that things like conflict become forces for good in your life instead of things you avoid at all possible opportunities to protect yourself from the fear of rejection, for example? How do you learn to love yourself enough that you become the first person that you really genuinely want to defend?
Now, Dalen, you also just launched a webtoon series called The Liminal. What can you tell folks about that?
I did. Oh God. Okay. The Liminal is like my brainchild baby for the longest time. This is actually, The Liminal predates Wyff Wolf, and I had to initially shelve it because when I put out the first chapter of The Liminal back in 2016-ish, essentially what it ended up serving as was like a proof of concept that I could do sequential stuff. So I ended up taking on other comics jobs and really, you know, sort of like establishing my foothold in this industry. And this ended up being sort of a back burner project as a result. But it is my baby that I love very, very much and that I have so much to say about. So we can't get me too started on it. But I'm super, super excited to be revisiting it. Especially now I am revisiting it with a skill level that I did not have initially when I first started drawing it. I'm really getting to do it up the way I really want to do it this time. And I'm super excited to be sharing it with the public, but without further ado, it is a cosmic horror murder mystery kind of deal set on the backdrop of a world where essentially about 20 years ago, road construction unearthed this artifact that introduced magic into the world. So it is a modern fantasy story wherein magic and the internet both became like ubiquitous pieces of world, like world infrastructure and world culture at the same time. And on this backdrop is my main character. Her name is Taylor. She functions as a quote unquote magician, which is essentially a freelance magic user who is there to unfuck the things you fuck with magic. And essentially in her attempts to help people out and, you know, make rent for the month, she gets drawn into this much larger, scarier plot.
Additionally, gush at least a little bit. Obviously, we haven't seen new Liminal, but Liminal V1 was able to capture so much of Dalen's incredible visual style. The color just leaps off the page, and the protagonist is immediately charming. she's a little weirdo, but like has the best grin, and you really do fall in love with her, and the world itself is really intoxicating. So once people do read Wyff Wolf and they say, my God, I need more, they'll have the Liminal waiting for them, and they're going to be absolutely delighted to be stepping once more into Dalen's totally twisted technicolor rainbow of a world.
I'll send you guys the pages for sure, because let me tell you, the 2023-2024 pages of The Liminal are a totally different beast. I'm very excited about that.
Gotta imagine.
That's exciting. Now, Colin and Jackson, you guys have way too much other stuff going on to get into right now. So I'll let you guys kind of, you know, craft the lightning round here. What do you need to get a plug in for at this point?
Well, you know, I think really at the end of the day, the thing that we are concerned about people reading right now is Wyff Wolf. We want them telling their stories about this book because it's not the kind of thing that necessarily everybody picks up. It's a 100-page OGN. That's a unique thing in the marketplace. So Wyff Wolf really is just like our number one priority. That same year or that same month, so Wyff Wolf comes out at the end of April, as you said at the beginning of the podcast, but on April 5th, we have a book called The Principles of Necromancy that is coming out from Magma Comics, which is a brand new imprint by Denton Tipton and Bobby Curnow, who left IDW and started up this creator-owned. And when I tell you that Denton hounded us for a year to be like, so what's your book? What's your book? When can I get a book from you? I want a book for you. How are we going to do this book? And the whole time I was like, you know, sure, Denton, like, absolutely, man. Just as soon as there's a company, like, show me the money, show me the contract, and we'll do it. But, like, we're not going to create, we don't have time. We are, as you said, very busy for people who aren't aware of our work, right? Right now, just right now alone, we just finished up Batman Beyond. We just finished up Guardians of the Galaxy. We are picking up an unannounced Marvel book. We have Outsiders at DC, which effectively functions as a sequel, like a direct sequel to our favorite book of all time, Planetary. And then simultaneously, we're running the Star Trek line over at IDW, and we're kicking off. They just announced some Farscape stuff that we're doing with Boom as part of the 25th anniversary edition. So, like, we're very spread thin in terms of that sort of corporate comics world, not to mention all the other stuff we're doing that isn't in comics. We just finished up on a TV show. We're doing a video game. Like, we're very busy. So for us, creator-owned has become imperative. It's like a thing we absolutely need to do because we haven't done it in so long because we got so used to doing this thing. So Denton came to us and said, hey, when do you have time? What can I do? How can we make this work? And eventually he finally cracked us down by pulling out one of the best creator-owned contracts we've ever seen and like an advance that actually made sense. Not for us, we don't pay ourselves out of an advance, but for our artist, Eamon Winkle, who was able to then make his, not only get, you know, ownership over the book with us, but also pay his rent. That really became a process where we felt, you know, okay, now we can really do this book. And so what we brought him, partially because we knew we were going to launch Whipwolf and we wanted to make sure that we had something similar in market, to tie back so that inevitably somebody who found Whipwolf could find this and somebody who found this could find Whipwolf, is Principles of Necromancy, which is the story of a world where it's like a medieval fantasy world where magic does not exist, where the closest thing to magic, like ours, like the actual medieval era, the closest thing you actually had to wizards were doctors, healers and herbalists and people like that who understood the truths behind life and death, which most people do not. And as a result, you would, you know, avert your eyes from them because, you know, God help, they look you in the eye the wrong way, and you become subject to their terrible knowledge. In our world, there are about 20 medical doctors. These 20 medical doctors are the equivalent of wizards. They are the equivalent of the most dangerous scientists you could meet. And they wander the world doing their terrible slash glorious work. Our story is about the youngest of these doctors, a man named Dr. Jacob Eyes, so-called because he has replaced his eyes with lenses that fit inside of his giant surgical mask that he has crafted out of skin and bone. In each issue, he is going into a different fantasy scenario, anything from like Conan the Barbarian to Victorian sort of horror to even like fantasy science fiction. It's all with a sort of like Dark Souls, Elden Ring kind of vibe because of the incredible art by Eamon Winkle. And in each issue, he walks into these scenarios and changes these scenarios with his first draft on necromancy, his first draft on magic. He has decided he is going to cure death, and what comes next is going to be his great work. So in each issue, each issue is a one and done. You can pick up issue two without picking up issue one. You can pick up issue three without picking up issues one and two. But if you read all of it, you're going to get a wider narrative. Similar in some ways to the early days on Hellboy. Mignola is a huge influence on this book, and we really wanted to like give the reader that same modular experience that then snowballs as they go along, as they understand the true nature of Eyes, the true nature of his work, and maybe the true nature of the evil in this world. It's been an absolute delight to work on. Everybody involved with it is just killing it. Jay Photos is on colors and is just nailing it. And it's Eamon Winkle's debut, similar to Dalen debuting for in Whipwolf as a sequential artist. Eamon is mostly a pinup artist who has been wanting to do sequentials for a long time and finally felt like the time was right. So anybody who's like a big fan of Kelly Jones or Greg Capullo, I think is going to see a lot of really similar vibes in Eamon's work. But from a man who's just getting started. So I can't wait for people to see Principles of Necromancy. It's going to be a hell of a book. It's very unique for us. Like anybody who loved our Guardians run and the sort of like emotional devastation we visited upon you every issue, I think might find a similar vibe going on in Principles.
I am so excited for this book.
Yeah.
And honestly, it's really cool because it does actually really sit hand in hand with Whiffwolf. If you want our take on Universal Monsters, you get Whiffwolf, you get your werewolves, and over in Necromancy, you get our Frankenstein. They are not werewolf and they are not Frankenstein, but they are, you know, just cat-cornered those concepts enough that I think it's kind of cool. April gets to be our, like, weird horror month. We're bringing spooky season into spring for some reason. I love it.
Spooky season is every season for me, thankfully. What were you going to say, Colin?
Oh, what was I going to say? I was just going to kind of point out also, it's a really interesting expose into kinds of different masculinities. Dr. Eyes is absolutely a twisted son of a bitch, but he also is, in a lot of ways, strangely much healthier than Paul. I feel like Eyes and Charity would be able to have a discussion even as she saw into his eyes and realized the monster that lurks underneath. It's just going to be really interesting for folks. And in a lot of ways, we are also unleashing some truly disgusting storytelling. if you liked our Clayface, basically was my point. Clayface really danced the line between beauty and the grotesque. And how you can find beauty in the grotesque. And I think that is something that Principles of Necromancy absolutely lenses in on. We are not gross for gross's sake. We are gross because the human experience can be disgusting. And the one thing that Dr. Eyes does not fear is the honest truth. So we're very excited for this year.
Right on. Well, folks, this has been a fantastic time. Final question before we release you back into the world. How can people follow you online and keep up with Whiffwolf and everything else that you respectively have going on?
I am easily found at Jackson Lansing on Twitter. As long as I decide to stay there, one of these days I will disappear. But until then, you can find me at Jackson Lansing on Twitter. You can find me on Instagram at Found in the Wild. You can find me at pretty much every comics convention this year, apparently. I'm just at every show, so come say hi.
You can find me on X, Twitter, at CP Kelly. You can also find me over on Blue Sky at colinkelly.bluesky.whatever the thing is. But that's me over there, too. But honestly, if you want that good Whiffwolf content, you should just follow Dalen.
Well, hilariously, I have kind of... I've kind of disappeared off the internet in recent months. I have really embraced my cryptid side. I do have social media accounts. They are a little bit less active than they used to be. You can find me at Dalen Ogden on Twitter. I refuse to dignify it by calling it X. I'm not doing that. But you can find me at Dalen Ogden on Twitter. You can find me at Dalen, just my first name twice, on Instagram, and my side comics account, which is at Dalen, but it's DALEN. And that's like the one where I share more of my comic stuff, specifically a little bit more like the liminal focused. Truly, if you want to hear the most from me and confirm that I am alive and kicking and well, the best place to actually find me is either on the app, the Line Webtoon app, by following the liminal, or by supporting me on Patreon. Like, $5 a month makes a huge difference for my quality of life. It buys brown cereal for my dog, and rats for my pet snakes. So any of that is super, super appreciated, but obviously not required. But those are the places you can find me.
All right. Thank you, all of you, for coming on the show.
Thank you so much for having us. This is always such a hoot.
It is an absolute pleasure. Thank you for having us. And seriously, thank you for spotlighting Whiffwolf.
Yes, thank you.
And Matt, thank you very much. And we really hope to see you guys again.
That's it for this week's show. As a reminder, WMQ&A is part of Comics XF, where you can find this podcast along with our sister podcasts, Battle of the Atom and Bat Chat with Matt and Will, a Batman ranking podcast co-hosted by Matt Lazowitz and Will Nevin. You can listen to WMQ&A on Apple Podcasts, SoundCloud, Amazon Music, Audible, and at comicsxf.com, where new episodes move Tuesday mornings. You can support Comics XF at patreon.com/comicsxf. where a $1 donation gets you a shout-out at the end of every episode of WMQ&A. A $2 donation gets you early access to WMQ&A and a shout-out at the end of every episode.
A $3 donation gets you a sticker, early access, and a shout out. A $5 donation gets you access to our monthly bonus podcast, Our Son Pete, a deep dive into the comic appearances of British mutant super spy Pete Wisdom. A $25 donation lets you request a primer, one of our custom reading guides for a series, character, or creator. And a $50 donation lets you advertise on the show. Big thanks to our patrons, Joel Elod, Shelf Dust, Lisa Slack, Will Redman, Tobias Carroll, Mike Sagawa, Will Nevin, Liz Large, Asimov Fangirl, Carla Pacheco, and Robert Secundus. You're all special, and we love you. You can follow ComicsXF on Twitter at ComicsXF, me at Daniel P. Grote, and Matt Lazowitz at MattLaz1013. You can also follow ComicsXF on Facebook, Instagram, and Blue Sky. And until next week, remember, a supervillain once tried to trick Superman and Big Barda into making a sex tape.
WNQA.